Hey, this is Justin Towns Earl, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to Walking the Floor. Got that right. I am totally insane this week because I'm trying to get ready to leave for tour for the first time in quite a while. I'm going to be gone for like a month and a half, so I got a lot of loose ends I got to tie up this week, and I'm trying to jam in a bunch of interviews so I can keep the podcast going while I'm out on the road. That's been good. I got some good ones in the can. As a matter of fact, in like a couple of hours, I'm going to go interview Sheryl Crow. Superstar Sheryl Crow. So I'll get that up soon. Well, that's assuming she shows up. And I know she had a gig last night. So fingers crossed, I'm going to be interviewing Sheryl Crow here later today. You know what else I did this week that I wanted to tell you about? I did one of those jam in the van sessions. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's pretty cool. They have like this mobile home, and you go and you play like a really short set. You just play a few songs, and we did that. Not Foo Fighters, but you know, for my solo thing, and it was really fun. And because of some scheduling misunderstandings on my part, we were supposed to go early in the day, and then we wound up going last. And my buddy Luke, that plays with me usually on the drums, wasn't able to come because he had some other stuff going on. So I called up my old pal Milo, that you may remember from the Dead Peasants a few years ago. And I sent him the songs. He hadn't heard the album or anything, and he learned them in like a couple. He was at work when I called him. And he just listened to them real quick, charted them out, came down. And what you're going to see on Jam in the Van is like maybe like either the first or second time he ever tried playing any of those songs. And he nailed it. So thank you, Milo. That show was pretty funny. It was like a lot of people, I think maybe everybody, was stoned out of their mind. It's like they had like THC-infused soda pop on tap. And as you probably know from listening to the show, I don't partake in the marijuana. Nothing against it, but it's just not something I do. And so that was kind of funny. Funny scene over there. Lot of glassy-eyed, nice people kind of doing their thing. All right, you know, first stop this week for me is over there in London, where I'm going to be doing a couple of solo shows. I hope you all are coming out to them. The one at Water Rats on June 14th is sold out, but I believe there's still some tickets left for June 13th, opening up for Nick from Jet over there at the 100 Club. So come on out to that if you can. Okay, so you may recall last week I asked if you, the listeners, had any gear questions or topics you wanted me to cover. Only got a couple responses that I saw on the Twitter. One of them asked me to talk about Charvel guitars, which I thought was interesting because I don't play or own any Charvel guitars. When I think of Charvel guitars, I think of like Eddie Van Halen, I think, played them back in the day, and like maybe Jakey Lee, you know, a lot of like the guitar players in the shred era played them. So maybe I'll have to go do some research on Charvel guitars and maybe get my hands on one before I cover that. But one topic that was asked about that I do know a thing or two about is acoustic guitars. And this is especially topical considering my shows in London are going to be acoustic, it's tough because to me, acoustic guitars never really sound great going through amplification of any kind, whether that's, you know, you put a pickup in them and you run it through like a DI and you run it into the PA. And to me, it always just sounds thin and clacky and shrill. And maybe I'm just using the wrong stuff or I don't know how to use it. I think I have Fishman pickups, which I was told are like, you know, those are like the best ones. So I put them in a couple of my Martins, and I, you know, compared to other ones I've used, they sound pretty darn good. But there's just nothing compares to the way an acoustic guitar sounds in a room unamplified. That is like the greatest sound in the world. And you stick some electronics in it and you run it through a PA. I don't know. I've seen like bands at every level, including, you know, myself, trying to do that. And it just never, to my ear, sounds good. I think if you're going to go that route, if I had the discipline to do it, I would just put a microphone on an acoustic and not use a pickup. But then you're like, you're pretty limited because you have to stay right in the same spot. And that's kind of hard when you're playing a gig. And I'll tell you what, I have, like I said, I got a couple of Martins, but the greatest acoustic guitar that I own is actually a 65 Gibson Country and Western. And that has nothing in it and never will. I'm just going to leave it like the way it came out of the factory. And it sounds amazing. I wish live your acoustic guitar could sound like that, but it just never does. If anybody out there has like some suggestions on how to make acoustics sound good, feel free to tweet them at me because I just honestly don't know. And the acoustic guitars that I probably play the most, I have like these four Gretsch cheapo like $100 acoustic guitars that are just made out of like presswood or something, and they got like cartoon shit all over them. So I bought those years ago and just kind of leave them around my house, and I play them more than anything else. But if I'm gonna go do a show, it's gonna be a Martin with a Fishman, and you know, if I'm gonna go record, it's gonna be that 65 Gibson Country and Western. So there you go. That's my acoustic guitar roundup for this week's Walking the Floor podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And feel free to tune me up on Twitter if anything I said there doesn't jive with your knowledge of acoustic guitars and miking them and amplifying them. Okay, why don't you get on over to Zounds.com and get yourself an acoustic guitar to mess around with, you know, on your own. Because, you know, Zounds makes acoustic guitar gear affordable. And they're happy to split your order total over like 4, 6, 8, or 12 monthly payments. And they never charge interest. So Zounds.com is the place for you online to get all your acoustic guitar needs, all your, and even if it's not an acoustic guitar, get some strings, get a Charvel, get whatever you want. Zounds.com. Okay, let's get on over to the interview. Okay, so I caught up with Justin Towns Earl last week at my studio at Walking the Floor World Headquarters in Mar Vista, California, when he was just finishing up the first leg of some touring. He's got a new record called Kids in the Street on a new label and a new baby on the way. So things are looking up and up for my man Justin Towns Earl. You know, you may not know it, but he is the son of a legend. He doesn't lean on it too much, but his dad is singer-songwriter Steve Earle, an elder statesman of the Americana world and country music in general. He's also named after a legend, Towns Van Zandt, and he has been hard at work on his own legend for the last 10 years or so, constantly touring and putting out records. I think my favorite line from this interview was there was a point where I was asking him about, you know, his sort of wayward behavior in his youth and if he was self-aware at that time and realized that, you know, he was sort of a reflection of his dad's bad behavior. And he said, my dad's crazy, but I'm a gangster. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. This is Justin Towns Earl on Walking the Floor. Are you starting a tour tonight?
No, this is the tomorrow night's the end of the first round.
Oh, the end of the first round. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought you were at the beginning of
We started at Stagecoach, like.
Oh, okay. I actually played at Stagecoach with you a few years ago.
Really? Oh, yeah.
On one of those, it was like a stage. Dwight Yoakam was headlining.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, I think first. Right. And you were somewhere in the middle. Right. Yeah. That's a good festival, man. That festival.
It's a wild one. I mean, it's equal parts what the fuck am I doing here? And
well, it depends on what stage you wander over to, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I went back. I was there one. I've been there a couple times. I played it once, but I've been there a couple times, and I wandered into like some mega line dancing tent once where there was just like super buff dudes in cowboy hats with their shirts off, and I was just like, this is like the happiest, like, I don't know, I'm a rock guy. Like, when there's big crowds of people like that, they're usually doing something shittier than what was going on in that. You know, it was just a weird, like, how did all these buff dudes get into dancing? I don't know. Like, I don't know who these guys were hanging out with growing up. You know what I mean?
It's just shit. Well, they're Southern, and you know, probably they want to be Southern. They want to be country, and they don't know that like old Buck up there would want to beat them to death if he saw him do that.
I looked, I noticed that you've got like a bunch of, European dates coming up.
Yeah.
Do you get out of the States much when you're touring?
I do, you know, I concentrated on, I've kind of fell in love with touring in Australia. And so I concentrated on it because I have a old friend who's actually my booking agent over there. And he's like, do you want to come in, do Melbourne, Sydney, Perth and go home? He was like, or do you want to play Bulleye and Wollongong and Mullumbimby? And do you want to go to these places, right, these weird places? So I go to Australia for 5.5 weeks.
Really?
And tour the country very extensively from Darwin all the way down.
I've never done one of those. I would love to do one of those tours.
Love police touring. Love police. That's what he calls himself.
Yeah. Oh, that's the tour. That's the
promoter.
Yeah,
he does the Black Keys, and he does My Morning Jacket, and me, and Dawes, and
oh, it's heaven down there, man. Especially like I'm a Californian, you know, born and raised, and so for me, when I go to Australia, it's like got like it's like California meets this cool like English influence thing, and then you know, kind of better than both,
right?
You know,
yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Like I was thinking of it as like what California could have been. Had we not fucked it all up?
Right. You know right. I mean? Well, you see all those animals and you think, you wonder about like what, like maybe this is what the San Francisco Bay looked like at one point. You right. know, all these weird birds and plants.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
It's possible.
Let's cover all that shit with oil.
Exactly.
Let's kill it off. Like you have a reputation as being like a road dog. I mean, I guess everyone's kind of a road dog nowadays in today's music industry because it's the only way to make a buck. But you do have a, you know, are known as being a guy that tours a lot. Do you like touring?
I love touring. It's the one, you know, I started touring when I was 15 years old, initially with two brothers who we went around and played coffee shops. And then I did.
You've got siblings?
No, these were other, like, two brothers that I met. Yeah, right. I do have a younger, nobody has the same mothers, but we have the same father. And, but, you know, it's something that I found at 35 years old that I'm trying to figure out, you know, I know how the road works, and I'm good at it, and it's automatic for me. You know, I'm in there. It's when I get back home that I have a little bit of problem adjusting.
Well, it's always that readjustment period, you know, like I always find when I'm touring a lot, you know, I get in an argument with my wife when I leave, and I get in an argument when I come home.
Yeah.
And if you're only home for a week, that's pretty much like your whole week.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that you're like sober nowadays, or at least I read that. You know, I don't know how much you want to talk about that or not, but I've been sober for you know 10.5 years or something too, and that changed touring a lot for me. You know, and I in some ways, you know, I mean, who doesn't want to be like 25 again or whatever and doing that? But in some ways, I think I enjoy it more now, or I certainly get more out of it.
Absolutely,
as far as like traveling and you know being sort of engaged in my surroundings and seeing where I am and you know, going to the local museum or whatever it is, you know, eating the local thing that you're supposed to eat, whatever that, all that stuff is. Like, how did it change for you when you sort of changed your lifestyle?
Well, it changed everything. I mean, it's you know, I was actually talking about it last night with the Sadies. Is one thing.
They're on tour with
you. Yeah, they're on tour with me. And they have a lot of friends who show up at shows, you know, really good old friends in all cities, all over the place. I don't have those people because I was sober when my first record came out, so I didn't sleep on couches. I paid for that hotel room.
Right.
I wasn't going to the party.
Yeah.
And so there are those weird things where it's like I got to dodge that portion of the touring and so when I actually started making records, I was sober. Mm. So I got all my craziness out of the way as a coffee shop musician and a roadie.
You roadied too?
Yeah, I was a guitar tech for 2 years.
Okay.
And then I did local crew calls in Nashville for for quite a while.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I have my facts a little jumbled up there. I thought that sobriety was more of a sort of a recent.
No. Thing for well, you. Okay. I would. No. I was there. It gets jumbled because I get jumbled. You know. I was.
Don't
I was,
we all?
I was completely sober for about 8 years. Hmm. I fell off. I came back and then I fell off again, ended up on the Suboxone program, got off the Suboxone 5 years ago, you know, and, you know, and I am a participant in the marijuana maintenance program.
Right. Yeah. I call that European sobriety. Right,
exactly.
European. All my European friends are like, yeah, I've been sober for, you know, years. You want to smoke a joint?
Yeah. And then you get the Spanish ones that are like, you want to have a wine? It's like, no, I don't drink, but it's just wine.
It's just wine. Yeah. Yeah. It's just beer. What do you mean? Exactly. Come on. Well, let's talk about your new album a little bit.
Yeah.
So, this is the first album that you've made outside of Nashville, right?
Yes.
Now that struck me as odd because I thought you were a New York guy. Did you not live in New York for
a time? I did.
I mean, I know you grew up in Nashville. Yeah. Right.
And I lived, New York is like it's my place. I mean, I don't live there now, but I have every intention of going back. And it's that awe-inspiring place for me.
Sure.
I love Manhattan in particular. And, but no, I always, you know, when it came to making records, it was just like, if you want to gamble and get hookers, you fly to Vegas. If you want to make records, you fly to Nashville, you know, is the way that we always saw it. And it's like, no matter what music industry town there is anywhere, we still got the better players in Nashville.
Right. Of course.
You know, and there's more of them there. So you got this pick. So the idea, like when you thought about if you grow up in Nashville, the idea of making a record anywhere else just sounds stupid.
Of course, you know? Yeah.
So it was
that really became clear to me. I mean, I hadn't spent a whole lot of time in Nashville over the years. It was like a place that we always just kind of drove through on tour. Like we'd play and most of the time not even spend the night, you know, to get to somewhere else. And I spent about a week in Nashville with Foo Fighters a couple years ago and got to experience some of the like local musician, you know, working musician people and check that out. And then I made a record there last summer. And it really, it was shocking to me the level, like I always knew it was a music town and incredible players and all blah, 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 all that stuff. But the difference in the level of musicianship there with everybody working in the music industry versus what I'm used to out here in LA is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, you just get this, it's nowadays, you know, I do describe Nashville as, you know, 15 pounds of shit in a 5 pound sack. Now, you know, the problem is you got to get that 10 pounds off the top to get down to what's actually supposed to be in that sack.
Right. But even with all the mainstream stuff, there's all those cats that, many guys that are not a part of that are incredible.
Incredible. You know? And even the guys that are a part of that, the players.
Right.
Like, I mean, and you know, and it's one of those things you have to get used to in Nashville too. I mean, especially pedal steel players, they'll get snapped up because there's so few of them.
Right.
So I've had two different pedal steel players. One now plays for Josh Turner, one plays for Miranda Lambert, you know, and so they get, you can't get pissy when they get that good job. And that's one thing that doesn't happen as much in Nashville because it is such a player oriented community. When somebody has to leave the band that they were in because they got a $1,500 a week, you know, job playing steel, everybody applauds them.
Right.
Says, great. Right. Congrats. You know,
you don't hate the guy for life.
Exactly. You might hate him for a few minutes, but you still congratulate him on what he's got, you know, and you get over it fast.
I mean, have you always done that on your records? Like, just assembled musicians from record to record, or do you have a regular band that you work with?
I had somewhat of a regular band that I used, for a little while, but like so the first 4 or 5 records are for the most part the same band, the same core band, drummer, bass player, piano player, and all that stuff all stays together. I mean, I did kind of work with a crew of, and then there was like a bass crew and then this revolving cast of people that went around it. And so when I went to make this record, it was the first time I'd worked with non-Nashville musicians and non, you know, just a place where it's the first time I ever recorded where if I didn't like the way the guy played, there was nothing I could do about it. You know, because where were we going to get another one?
Right.
We're going to have to sit here.
You can't just go get another pedal steel player. Where were you, in Omaha?
I was in Omaha, Nebraska. Right. Yeah. And with Mike Mogus.
Right. Producing.
Yeah. And which was also interesting, too, putting. Yeah, I've worked in a co-production kind of sense with people. I've never had an out-and-out producer on a record before. So working with different musicians, working with a producer, working in a different state, in a different city, it did make it easy that Mike and Connor got them a nice little studio out there in the middle of Omaha. It's a really good place. And Mike's just like, too, if you look at the credits on my record, like, the guy plays like 13 instruments or something.
Oh, really?
On that record.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, the Mike Mogus dude.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he's a multi-instrumentalist.
He is, yeah. He's one of those guys making records with him. I found that you have to, more than anybody I've ever worked with, like, and I kind of read this off of him only after I started working with him, is that I wasn't going to, I'm there day one, I'm there for every mix, I'm there for mastering, I'm a parrot on the shoulder. And I realized in that was not going to be the way that things needed to work with Mike. Mike needed alone time with the music.
Oh, really?
He wants to take and play his parts.
Right.
And then deliver them
present
to you.
Present
them to you.
Right.
And
fully realized.
Exactly. And,
right.
And I'd never done that before, you know, ever.
Yeah, that's an interesting letting go of control that I think is difficult, you know, for anybody, but especially for, you know, the artist, the songwriter, the leader of the charge, you know.
Absolutely. And it makes it to where, but it was, you know, I had to kind of, you know, I left, we were there for 2 weeks and I left and there was still, nothing had been mixed yet, and he hadn't put any of his parts on it yet when I left.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was a very different sounding record when you heard it, I'm guessing.
And he sent everything to me as he did it, you know.
Right.
But I never, you know, other than that, I have my engineer who's worked with me for years. The one safety, my make me feel good safety net is that my personal engineer didn't work on the record, but he was a assistant, basically.
Ah, okay.
Over the
phone.
So
you had a mole in there that you trusted.
Yeah, well, Mike was sending him straight to Adam.
Right.
And Adam would listen to it and just be like, you know, he could give him a very good idea of whether he was wasting his time or not and how to tweak things. And so we did the same thing. The mixes went from Mike to my guy to me.
Right.
In a circle like that.
Right. And you're happy with the result?
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, it's a funny thing. I always say by the time you're done making a record, you kind of, you maybe not hate it. Maybe that's too strong, but you're fucking sick of it because you've been with it for months and months and months, from the writing of it to the, you know, learning it with your band or whatever, to then going and recording it. Makes it like, by the end of that whole process, you're usually just like, fuck, I never want to fucking listen to this thing again, you know? But
absolutely.
you must not have had that experience on this one.
Not as much. I mean, it was especially because I wasn't there for the mix at all, you know? And I think I found that's the part that fries me.
Right, sure.
Because I also don't do, one thing that I refuse to do is my vocals are got with the basic track.
Mm.
Period.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you don't go back in? And
no, I don't
do
like. I hate doing that. I've never.
Are you playing and singing at the same time? Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So
that is committing.
I try to.
I imagine you're getting vocal in the guitar mic and vice versa, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I like my bass. I like my vocal, bass, drums, guitar, all tracked live.
Mm.
When I do
click, no click,
no click.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. No click at all. And that was. That was when, you know, and Mike had to get outside of his comfort zone because he likes the click.
Right.
You know, he does.
Yeah, sure.
He does. And
as a producer, and I assume he mixed it, like that gives him more freedom to, you know, take the bridge was better in this take. Can we stick it over here?
Exactly.
You know, that becomes harder when you remove those sort of modern comforts.
Yeah. And when when you track your vocals live, you thwart them in comping.
Right.
You know,
right.
When you track the vocals live, they can't really come.
Yeah, what you get is what you get.
Yeah, and I tend to get a little sneaky, and I'll change like little phrases, little little bits, and Mike would call and just be like, man, you didn't get, you said something different. Which one do you want? I was like, I just pick one. I like them all.
Right, right. Funny. Do you go into making a record with your songs completely written, or do you kind of put them together in there?
No, they're completely done. Completely done and together. I write records to be records. So groups of songs, like a concept record in the same way that, say, Born to Run is a concept record. It's based around a particular feeling, a place, a time, a people, you know, kind of thing, but not necessarily it's not exactly White Mansions, you know, it's not an epic, you know,
kind of thing. You're the only person I've ever interviewed that referenced White Mansions.
Really?
Yes. That's a deep, for those of you listening out there, go find that.
Yeah.
That is a deep
cut right there.
Well, okay. You know what? Actually, I stand corrected. You're not the first person. I interviewed Dave Cobb a couple of years ago, or a year and a half ago or whatever, and he's the one that talked about that record.
Yeah.
And I went and found it afterwards.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
I mean, I love it. It's great, but it's like, what? Huh? How'd that happen?
Exactly.
Had some guy who's A, English, and B, not a songwriter, write this album and then get all these superstars to come sing on it.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. Anyway, we were talking about you write, you know, albums as a whole, as a piece, you know, not necessarily a strictly conceptual, but, you know, to be an album.
Right.
Right.
Records to be records and songs that kind of just fit with one another. And you know, and I think that that's very, for me, that's very important when I walk into the studio to have that kind of, have everything cleared up. And it's rare when I walk up to a musician and say, what do you think you should do?
Right.
I walk up and I go, all right, let's start with this.
Right.
You know, like, let's just start with something like that, you know, and give ideas. I don't want to control whatever, but I just give people a place to start and go. And so it's a pretty fully formed thing in my head by the time I get into the studio, which I was difficult for me to not do this. I had to try to not fully form it this time in my head, which was it didn't work. I kept trying to form it in my head and it kept changing, but that was the plan anyway.
Do you do a lot of like extensive demoing and stuff, and are you a multi-instrumentalist yourself? Like, do you play a lot of—
I play guitar, that's it. And I barely, like, I have a guitar style that, like, I don't know any theory whatsoever. I don't know what I'm— exactly. I know the capo goes there, fingers go there, and I'm like, and
you do a lot of finger style.
Oh yeah.
I mean, how'd you get into that? Like, what's your take on that? Do you use finger picks and all that stuff, or
no? Just my thumb and my index finger when I Travis pick. So I just do two finger.
Oh really?
Two finger picking. But then I do a SWAT kind of thing,
like claw hammer banjo kind of thing.
Almost like a claw hammer, except you're keeping the index finger free to get in the middle. So the three—
is that more of like a little rhythmic thing?
Yeah, so you go down with your thumb on the low, the high strings with your three fingers on the nails, but then as you come you're able to pull out your lead with your index finger as you
play. I mean, how did you develop that? How'd you learn that? Did you take a lot of guitar lessons when you were a kid, or did you just kind of—
I never took one. I
really—
yeah. You know, I was, you know, it was that I was the, like, you know, I'm 35 years old, so there was a defining moment in my career that, or in my life as a musician, which was the Nirvana Unplugged record. I got that record, and I was like, I was a huge Nirvana fan.
That's going to be the headline from this interview.
Yeah, exactly.
I learned fingerstyle from Kurt Cobain.
Yeah. But I get that. Yeah, I get that record. And Where Did You Sleep Last Night is on it. He does We're In the Pines, or My Girl, or whatever you want to call it. And of course, like every kid in America across the world, I thought that was a Kurt Cobain song.
Right.
And my dad says, oh, no, no, no. He goes, this is Lead Belly. I was about 11 or 12 years old. And
what were you listening to up until that point?
Well, I had every AC/DC record, you know, like every single one. My cassette tape collection was quite large. But I was that weird because my dad wasn't around, but he sent me records, and his like his wife, who was an A&R person in LA at the time, sent me records. So I guarantee I was the first kid in Nashville that was a Nirvana fan, because I had Bleach in 1989.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in Nashville, Tennessee. That shit early. So yeah, I knew I was a little kid, but I had that record, you know, and I still have the cassette, you know, and so it's. That, but that was the changing moment, was I was introduced through that song to Leadbelly. And I end up seeing videos of Leadbelly playing, and he's playing with his hand like this. And then, you know, here comes Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Woody Guthrie. And right there at that moment, my love of punk and rock and grunge or whatever anybody else could, just it's not that it stopped, but it just went back burner.
Right.
It didn't matter at that point.
Right.
And the wheels, just as I say, they turned, went in reverse.
Right.
And I started going backwards, and so I was one of those weird kids. While I did own, you know, Dr. Dre the Chronic and listen to it with my friends, you know, I was like sneaking off and listening to, you know, Bob Dylan's John Wesley Harding, you know, and things like that when I was about 12 and 13. And so by the time I was 15, I was already doing all this fingerstyle stuff, and ran off to the hills of East Tennessee when I left home. And I met this crazy old songwriter named Malcolm Holcomb, who showed me this. I watched him play guitar, and I was just like, wow.
Wait, back up here a second. So you ran off to the hills of Eastern Tennessee.
Yeah.
To do what? To go be like, pursue being a musician or whatever? What was that? How'd you pull that off? Sounds like a 15-year-old fucking dream, man.
I was in a lot of trouble. I mean, I was basically like I always had an advanced case of criminal, as my dad called it. You know? So I could get, and you know, I was at 14 years old, I could play you most of Leadbelly's catalog, but I could also get you a kilo of cocaine and an AK-47 if you'd like. You
know? Can we get that today?
If we're back east, I can take care of that.
Well, I read an interview with you where you mentioned something about, you know, being 12 or 13 and jumping into cars with older kids to drive off to punk rock shows in Memphis, and then, you know, and still try to get to school the next day, and then eventually you just quit going, kind of thing. And I thought, like, fuck, man, this guy had the exact same teenage years that I did. Yeah, you know, that was like my experience, you know what I mean? Was like trying to, you know, doing that, but it wasn't Memphis, it was LA, and I was growing up in Santa Barbara, you know, but.
Right.
But, okay, so anyway, so how did that lead to you running off into the hills?
Well, I met this songwriter named Scotty Melton, who, he was about 22 at the time, maybe 21, and I was 15, or I just turned 15 years old, and we were at a party, and he had been in town for a week, and we'd been hanging out, and I'd played songs for him that I'd written. I'd also...
So you were already writing songs at that point?
Yeah.
Were you performing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was doing whatever they'd let me do. I used to play at a bar in Nashville called the Springwater from noon until 7 p.m.
That's like Buck Owens at the Blackboard, you know, kind of 1958 kind of set. Like, I didn't know that was even still going on anywhere.
Yeah,
that's like how you get your chops down, like,
absolutely.
Amazing.
And you deal with, in the Springwater, you deal with a very rough clientele of...
You either figure out how to deal with a crowd...
You learn
and
to
manipulate a crowd a little bit, or you die trying.
Exactly, yeah. And so it was a big trial by fire, and you know, and I was one of those. I was very aware of what I was doing when I did it. Like, you know, I was when I you know, I knew I was getting an experience when I ran off to Memphis when I was 13 years old, and I knew that I was going to get something. I wanted to understand what was up with all that hillbilly music, and that's why I went to the hills in East Tennessee, and because, you know, that songwriter that I met told me, he's like, you're going to get killed. You're gonna be dead if you stay around here. He's like, you're writing songs. He was like, but you're
fucking up at the same
time.
Yeah,
well, he was the guy that introduced me to The Harder They Come.
Listen to this song, kid.
Yeah.
Listen to the lyrics. I mean, as that was all going on in your life, were you sort of aware of, you know, how the connection between your behavior at that time and, say, your dad's, reputation or you know, his life and the drug addiction, jail time, all that stuff, you know? Were you like self-aware of that sort of reflecting on you in a way?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was in a way, but there was, I knew that there's a distinct difference between me and my father and in that, like, you know, I'm my mother's son too.
Right.
Which, so take my dad's crazy and then add in a bit more of a violent streak and a, you know, and you get me, which, so is the trouble that my dad got into was, you know, when I say, yeah, he was a junkie, I'm a gangster, you know, is my thing.
I do my thing,
you know, I just get high now and then, you know, so it was, but I was always going to be, I knew that it was always going to be something. I was going to be in trouble with it one way or the other,
right.
You know. I was very, but I mean, by the time too, I was, when we were running off to Memphis, we were scoring like bags of really weak Mexican brown heroin and taking it back to Nashville. Mm. And I mean, so we were inner city kids.
Right,
I mean,
you were entrepreneurs.
Yeah. I mean, we were 12 years old. We were fucking and smoking weed and,
right,
you know, drinking Night Train.
Who are 12-year-olds selling Mexican heroin to?
We used to just do it.
Oh, okay. So that was before the, okay,
we'd just go buy it, right, and bring it back, right, okay, all this week. Cause you couldn't get heroin in Nashville in those days.
Really?
It was impossible to find. They had a heavy trade in Dilaudid back in the day because of that.
Right.
So it was the weirdest thing in the world. You used to go over to on the east side of town where everybody lives now.
Right.
There
what was the east side of town like back then?
It was horrible.
I only know it as
it was
hipsterville, you know.
It was basically the way that Nashville said, we used to say nobody ever goes. And Nashville, and this is saying something, cuz Nashville when I was a kid was a shithole. I mean, it was dangerous. It was rough. There weren't nice neighborhoods really anywhere. The whole inner city area surrounding downtown and all that stuff, there were a few little pockets, but it was a really tough town. East Nashville was the toughest of it. And we used to say that the only time that people from this side of the river go to the east side is when their cousins get out of prison and they go to a party at their aunt's house. East Nashville was, the old workhouse was right there where they used to, like, if you got your drunk tank time or your petty drug time, you used to drive by and see all the guys in their orange jumpsuits right out there on the highway.
Pick up trash on the highway.
Well, where they put it, no, it's a little fenced-in building right by the projects. And so the guys in the fences, you used to be able to go over, walk past the fences to the workhouse, and they'd point you to where they moved the dope spot to that day. So they were using the guys in the yard to help shuttle people to the dope spots.
Oh man, it's so different now. It's crazy. I mean, everything changes, and you know, Silver Lake has come to every town in America.
Absolutely.
In that sense. And it's in some positive ways and then in some negative ways. You know, people being pushed out of neighborhoods they've lived in all their lives.
Nashville's definitely taken it more of a negative. It's
really?
way negative.
Right.
It's pretty incredible what they're
doing.
It
seems like a town that is exploding with construction as well.
Yeah.
Which, and usually when you see that, means that a lot of what was there is now gone.
Is gone. Right. Yeah. That's the thing, is they have no regard whatsoever for old buildings or anything.
Which
like
is a shame in such a place that means so much historically to this country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, it was the fact that, I mean, it just kills me that they built a new piece on the Ryman. It's like, why did they need a new lobby on the Ryman?
Did they really?
Yeah, they built this new, and we were mad when they built the old new lobby on the Ryman.
right.
You know, people get mad.
You're pining for that one.
Exactly. Then, well, people get mad, like, will ask me one time, they're like, why are you so mad about all this stuff going on in Nashville? I'm like, listen, I'm a native. I was born here. I was like, we're still mad about that goddamn thing that y'all call the Bat Building, and that went up in 1996. Okay, so
well, it's crazy. I mean, if you look at my only reference point for old Nashville stuff because I was never there at that time. But, you know, the movie Nashville, obviously, you see what, you know, it sort of looked like around town. And then there's this amazing little mini documentary thing on Elvis Costello. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Where he's making like what he thinks is a country record.
Right.
With Billy Sherrill.
Yeah.
In Nashville. But the way that downtown looks is so radically different in that because there's a lot of like street footage.
Yeah. And well, when I was a kid,
it was very cool looking. It looked like this cool little small town.
Yeah. And it was. When I was a kid, Nashville was a city of 400,000 people.
Right.
That's all that was there.
Right. So not much bigger, or maybe not bigger at all. I would have to look and see what the population, but that's, I want to say roughly what, where I grew up in Santa Barbara is.
It probably is.
Right.
Yeah. I'd say roughly about that. And it was a, like downtown Broadway where all the honky tonks are.
Mm-hmm.
All right, off of Broadway, there was nothing was open.
Right.
Nothing. I mean, the entire downtown was boarded up
right.
and shut.
So it was like businesses that had closed down.
Oh, yeah. Right. And then like the old Woolworths building and the old Sears Roebuck building still said Sears Roebuck and
but
was
it
just boarded up.
Right, yeah.
And but on Broadway, there were Tootsies. There was Roberts that opened up around, I can't remember, sometime in the 80s, but there was maybe three. The Wheel was down there.
Right.
There was like three honky tonks, Ernest Tubb Record Store, and a bunch of dirty bookstores and peep shows.
Right.
That's what Lower Broadway.
Were those clubs like Tootsies or whatever? Were they like sort of cover bands? Like in modern Nashville, you go there and those are like. I get the sense, and I could be dead wrong here, that like nobody makes it out of those clubs anymore. Those are clubs for tourists,
yeah.
Where there aren't like relevant, like you don't get a gig there because you're trying to go like, or maybe in your head you think you're going to make it, so,
yeah.
But you know what I'm,
yeah.
I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Like it's like a dead end, not an entry point.
Absolutely.
At that point, was it like that?
No. I mean, it wasn't so much for an artist to make it as it was a player. Now,
right.
the bigger bands would go down Lower Broadway and, yeah,
see they'd, some ripper
they'd harvest,
get that guy.
Oh, yeah. They'd
right.
harvest players out of there all the time. But it has changed. Like, the last time I played the Ryman, I was standing out back having a smoke. And all of a sudden, I heard somebody on the row of clubs break into Sweet Child of Mine, which I love. Appetite for Destruction. I love Guns N' Roses.
Right.
But I walk down and I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm getting closer and closer to Tootsies. And I got over there and sure enough, there was a band playing Sweet Child of Mine and Tootsies. Now, if Tootsie was still alive, the cord would be pulled and those boys would have been taken out back and beaten with their instruments. Now, I love that. Like I said, I love that song. I love GNR, but that's Tootsies.
Right. Not the place for it.
Not the place for
not
it.
Not the
you
proper
know.
Venue.
Yeah. And there, I mean, in the 90s, there was a great time down there. Yeah. The BR549 doing their thing at Tootsies. Legendary Shack Shakers and would play at Roberts or Layla's. Hillbilly Casino was going on down there. Greg Gehring and the Alphabet City Opry. All kinds. It was a really good time in the kind of mid-late 90s, early 2000s down there, which was kind of the rebuild of it. Because it
right.
was dead until BR started their year-long run there.
Really?
And like, I think that, God, when was it? It was in the 90s, but they did a year. They played every single night.
No shit.
Yeah.
Were they already making records at that point?
Yeah.
Or was that? Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was just the finally, like the, you know, we're gonna do the, you know, just do a local show. And it did. It was, which they would have wanted the credit until about 5 years ago for the revitalization of
right.
of Lower Broadway. BR549 is highly responsible for that. And Chuck Mead, yeah.
So when did, okay, so you're off in the hills of Eastern Tennessee. When did you come back and start, like, when did you start making records of your own or touring a lot? Or when did you enter that? What was your entry point into touring and recording and all,
well,
all that?
When we were living in the hills, we did tours, just us in a van. So we did.
Was that when you hooked up with the brothers?
Yeah, that's okay. Who I was living with up there.
And were you doing like old, you know, mountain music, bluegrass, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, bluegrass and acoustic blues and things like that mainly, and then the songs that I'd written kind of interspersed. So we toured a lot as a solo act, and then as solo acts, and then I moved when I left Johnson City. I moved to Chicago when I was 17. And that was another thing. I was trying to understand the Chicago blues thing a little bit more. Right. But I didn't stay in Chicago long. I got in a lot of trouble in Chicago really fast.
Really. But is that how you also connected with Bloodshot? Because that was your first label.
Yeah, it was. But this was like, God, it was years later. I mean, it wasn't until... I was 25 when that record came out on Bloodshot.
Okay.
So that's like all my records have been made in the past 10 years.
Really?
Yeah, all 8 of them have been in a 10-year stretch.
Right.
You know, so it was, I did make them very quickly. I mean, I made one a year, bam, 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 right, for Bloodshot. But my first record deal I got offered when I was about 18 years old. And I was working with Luke Lewis and Lost Highway Records on kind of a developmental kind of basis.
Right.
They got me in the studio, do some recordings, and I was, at that point, at 18, I was strung out, just strung the fuck out at that point. And so,
but, like, were you still functional in terms of writing a lot and playing and...
Yeah, I mean,
still doing it. Were you like a functioning?
Yeah, I was very functioning as far as the daytime, but then at night I'd get, you know,
yeah,
I'd like to. Then it was speedball time.
Strength of youth, baby.
Yeah, exactly. And so it, but yeah, I ended up losing that. They sent me to treatment. Music Care sent me to treatment.
Yeah,
gets me cleaned up. I come back out.
Right.
I get in trouble again immediately, and so then the record label's just like, well, we're maybe next time.
You know? Working with a relatively big label like that. I mean, they were through Universal, right?
Yeah.
Right. So essentially a major label. Was there pressure on you to sort of conform to, you know, some preconceived notion about, you know, the son of a, you know, legendary songwriter? You know, was there any of that sort of like them trying to push you in a certain direction? That you didn't want to go to?
No, there was, you know, I've never encountered that so far, but I was very forceful about that in the first place. I mean, my dad and I did have one of the things that we definitely agreed upon immediately. It was like when I told him my first record was coming out, you know, we sat down and we talked about it, and he's like, look, they're going to jump on you out of the gate. He was like, they're going to be ready to pounce on you. He was like, so here's the deal. He's like, we're not doing any shows together. He's like, don't play my songs. I won't play your songs. He was like,
just nip that whole storyline in the bud.
So, you know.
But I thought that you had started out touring in your dad's band or something.
I teched for his guitar player.
Okay. So you were
Eric Amble. I did like some utility stuff. Mm-hmm. Like dad played harmonica on one song, and they needed somebody to just hold down. Like I did that kind of stuff. Right. Yeah. And that's where I learned a lot of my, you know, being a taking care of aging rockers while they rock is, he will teach you a lot about the business.
Oh yeah. God damn it. Put the beer right here on my amp. Don't you know anything? Where's my gum?
Exactly.
Okay, so you eventually you hook up with Bloodshot.
Yeah, well, how Bloodshot happened, it was funny. I put out my first EP on my own, and my girlfriend at the time
was that Yuma.
Yuma, yeah, right. Gave me $1,000 to record it and press it, and I ended up going through several pressings of it. I sold 2,000 copies of it through...
It's probably the most money you ever made on a record release.
Exactly.
Because it all went right in your pocket.
Exactly. Yeah. But then I was doing... I got a little booking agency, this little tiny little agency that put together this, you know, kind of house concert tour thing for me. And I was doing that, and I was up in Chicago, and a place to stay had fallen through. And so a friend of mine made a phone call, and Rob from Bloodshot ended up being whose house we ended up staying. And so, and that's really, that's how it happened is I ended up just crashing at his house, and we were up talking, and then he was just like, oh, well, maybe I'll come to the show. And so he came to this little house concert in Evanston. And then 6 months later, I was, we were getting ready to go in and make the record for Bloodshot.
And you've bounced around a little bit on different labels. I saw that you were on Vagrant for a couple of records. Which I haven't, like, Vagrant started out as like a punk rock label years ago. But I'm not super familiar with like their roster or whatever, but I didn't know if that was an odd fit or
it was,
or was it like a subsidiary of Vagrant, or was it
no,
just Vagrant?
It was Vagrant. And you know, it was a an interesting one to me when it was brought up. I mean,
because they're based here, right?
Yeah, right. I think they are. And so I did the double, the single mothers, absent fathers with them, and we were there was some talk of continuing, but I thought better of it and and moved on to. Mainly, there was a bunch of people who, two people who moved to New West Records, which is why I ended up at New West Records. It's got nothing to do with the label itself,
right?
You know, because I think that's one thing that people make a mistake. It's like, man, I'm signed to Mercury. It's like, well, who's running Mercury?
Exactly.
That's the
question. Who's your champion within that label?
Well, John,
I mean, I talk about this all the time. There's so many people between the guy that makes the record and anybody ever hearing it, and you're so dependent on that pipeline of people to, you know, to everybody do their job the way they're supposed to, and for, you know, hopefully people are fired up and want to do it.
Yeah,
you know, because if they're not, nobody's ever going to hear about your record.
Yeah. And, well, John Allen moved there, and he's, you know, he's now the boss man. And so he worked with Bug Music in Nashville for years.
Right.
And that songwriter that I was telling you about that I went off to East Tennessee with was actually, it's how I met John Allen, was Scotty wrote for John Allen at Bug.
Okay.
And so I've known him for forever, and I know everything he's done in his career. And I love everything that he's done in his career. Same thing with Kim Bowie. Kim Bowie comes, and Kim Bowie's actually the A&R person that cut me loose from Lost Highway.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And now she's at New West. And
the person that signed you there?
Signed me there.
I mean, how important is it for you when you're out there touring a record to have a really good team behind you doing it?
Oh, very. I mean, I think that's one thing that you know, that's one of the biggest misconceptions of this business, is that there's more people behind the scenes than anybody can even imagine.
Right.
You know, it's,
you hope there's a few.
You hope there's a handful. Yeah. Yeah. It's like even at Bloodshot, you got three or four behind you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
so
yeah, sure.
Now you get to some place like New West, you got 10 or so behind you, something like that.
I mean, how much are you interacting with the people at your label? Do you have a manager as well? That's sort of doing the most of the interaction there?
Yeah, right. Pretty much. I'm pretty gruff. I'm to the point, and I hurt people's feelings.
The music industry does not appreciate to the point. That is not, in my experience, that is, I think I've alienated many people over the years by speaking my mind a little too honestly.
Yes.
A little
yes.
too direct.
Yes. Yeah. Give them the Bill Monroe. I appreciate what you're trying to do, son.
What is that?
Bill Monroe evidently said to some kid who at a bluegrass festival who was trying to play one of his songs, like he played it and like just butchered it, and as he was walking off stage, he was like having to walk toward Bill.
Oh, geez.
And Bill just puts his hands on his shoulder and just says, I appreciate what you're trying to do, son.
that kind of critique is hard to take sometimes.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, dude, for coming down here on show day. I know that's not always easy or something you necessarily even want to go do when you got to go play a gig at night, but I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm glad we could get over here and do it. This has been easy and nice.
Yeah, it's been good having you. Do you want to, would you be so kind as to play a tune?
Sure. I can do that. Cool. All right. Mm-hmm.
seat rated back. Look like she should be driving something long and black. All I'm asking is, all do you know her? Pretty little thing, and she drive that champagne Corolla. I seen her around here just last night. Today she been by 2-3 times. Ain't you listened to me? Now that I done told you, I'm pretty little thing, and she drive that champagne Corolla. So am I, so boys on the corner, did they know? They said I'm any of them things you think is out on the road. I say the one I mean, if you seen her, you would know her. Pretty little thing, drive that champagne Corolla. Alright, say she can run all week on just one thing, goes to show you, maybe baby got her head on her shoulders. She sure looks sweet when she drive that champagne Corolla. But I know that every man thinks that he needs some high tone woman, something built for speed, but you can't trust a rich girl, no fun you can throw her. Need a middle class queen, drop that champagne Corolla. Alright. Something, give me where I'm going, man. Like a pretty little thing, drive that champagne Corolla. So help me, baby, not jump on the side. If she'd have me, all she's gotta do is give a little tap on the shoulder. I'll ride away with the girl in the champagne Corolla. I'll ride away with the girl in the champagne Corolla.
Yeah! Nice work! That sounded fucking great, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll show it straight this thing.
All right, that was Justin Towns Earl with a Walking the Floor exclusive performance of Champagne Corolla. I want to get in that Champagne Corolla. Make sure you check out JustinTownsEarl.com. Check out all his tour dates. He's heading to Europe really soon. He's also on Twitter at JTE News. So go check him out, get his record, see what he's doing. While you're at it, get on over to the iTunes store. Did you know that there's almost 100 Walking the Floor interviews for you to choose from for your entertainment pleasure? Have you listened to them all? Probably not. So now's the time. Get on over and check them out. We are closing in on the 100 mark. While you're at it, get on over to your Spotify account and find the Walking the Floor playlist. I've been meaning to update it. I update it here and there. I got to get a little better about that. But it's a good playlist, man. Great for those road trips. I will see you soon in London, June 13th at the 100 Club, June 14th at Water Rats, and of course, way beyond that into the summer, all over Europe, Asia, and God knows where else. This is Chris Shiflett for Walking the Floor. We'll see you next week. Adios, amigos!